our Senate members meeting with us today. Happy to have you here. Folks, today this is the beginning of a two-week series of hearings that we have outlined to examine Oregon's revenue structure, and not only our structure, but then we from that options for reform and improvement. Some folks have asked me why we're doing this at the tail end of the session, and I think there are several reasons to do that. One, I think probably captures it most, is that when it's raining is a good time to go up on the roof and see where the water is getting in, and that's really where we are in this session. We are in the middle, I think, of dealing with the very problems with our revenue system that we have known have been coming, but in this first full-blown recession since the implementation of ballot measure 5, I think this has really exposed in spades the problems that we have structurally with our revenue system. And so the opportunity is present with us, and I think immediate at the end of this session, to look at how we got where we are and where might we feasibly be going in terms of improvements to our revenue structure. When there is broad consensus that we have a problem and that improvements are necessary. Granted, the consensus is not as great on what those improvements should be, but I hope that the hearings this week and the next week will help focus on some of the most viable solutions and options we have available to us, and then build some consensus and some energy behind those to move forward. With that, are there any? Does anybody else on the committee want to make some opening comments before we call on Paul Warner? Just to let you know, we have today an overview of history, an overview of our tax system, and some history of tax reform efforts in Oregon. We have the Honorable former Governor Vic Atiyah and former State Representative Tony Van Vliet, who has some personal history on tax reform efforts, here with us today to testify. We have invited testimony scheduled out for the rest of this week, with public testimony next week and testimony from legislative members, and then we will be moving forward from there as we see how our foundation is being laid. But with that, do any other members have any opening comments they want to make before we turn it over to the estimable Paul Warner to give us our overview from staff? All right, with that, I want to thank everybody again for their interest and attention today. Thank members and our Senate guests and members for being with us. And Paul Warner, why don't you take it over and lay the foundation here on the discussion of where we are, and begin our discussion of how we got here.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. The material that you have in front of you is really kind of a review of tax reform efforts over the last 20 years. You have some background on the 1986 plan that Governor Atiyah is very familiar with. We had the 1993 Measure 1 that went to voters in November of 93. We have the 98-99 review of the tax system under Governor Kitzhaber. They had both a technical review of the system under Measure 5, and then some policy recommendations. Then we also put in your packet the O2 Task Force, School Funding and Accountability Task Force, that you received right at the beginning of this session. There's also two other pieces of information. They're both titled Tax Reform Discussion. The first one is Tax Reform Discussion, House Revenue Committee, and then it has a listing of state tax collections by source for all the states. I've got some summary material of that and the overheads, but that, I think, is a real key as we look at Oregon's system, and it really stands out how unique our system is. And then finally, I put in just a copy of the slides I'll be going through with you. Again, that's also entitled Tax Reform Discussion. So I'll go ahead and start in and talk about the overview of our system. Really, there are four things to look at and to think about as we begin this process of the tax reform discussion. First is, what are the basics of Oregon's tax system? I'm sure you're all familiar with that, but it's probably helpful to stand back and look at some of the specific numbers and how we compare with other states. What are the problems caused by this system? Well, there's one that's very clear that the chair alluded to in terms of stability. The other longer-term issue is probably one that hasn't been discussed a lot, but that's the impact of relatively high marginal income tax rates on long-term economic growth, which becomes a key issue over time. And finally, what I'll do today is finish with a discussion of tax reform options. Tomorrow, for your meeting, we've invited Bruce Weber from Oregon State and Tony Ruffalo from Portland State to talk through the pros and cons of those different options to give you a sense of what kind of an academic sense of how those particular options are viewed and what their strengths and weaknesses might be. First, in terms of the overall revenue system, this, I think, is a chart you're familiar with. It looks at Oregon's revenue system from the 1999-2000 census. Now, you'll see the state information we're looking at is for a fiscal year 2002, but the census data lags behind on the local data. So if you're looking at a comprehensive view of the state local system, the most recent information we have is 99-2000. And as we've said a number of times, that is the very peak of the bubble. So those numbers are a little distorted in terms of overall revenue that's generated by the system. But the first point to remember is that when we talk about tax revenue, we're talking only about half of the general revenue as census defines it. Oregon ranks relatively high in terms of its general revenue, at least in 99-2000, because it is very high in those non-tax revenue sources, particularly federal revenue and charges and fees and also miscellaneous revenue, which includes lottery. So those three areas, Oregon is high. But if you look at the tax burden or taxes as a percent of income, we rank relatively low. And again, this is 99-2000 is the year we were generating about $400 million in capital gains revenue. So that revenue is basically what's gone away. And you'll see how the state numbers look when we pull ahead 2 years to the 02 fiscal year. The revenue system, of course, stands out very clearly in its dependence on the personal income tax. Personal income taxes as a percent of income are 4.6%. In this 99-2000 data, New York did have a slightly higher personal income tax burden, so we ranked 2. Usually we've tended to bounce and trade off with New York over the 90s, ranking either 1 or 2 in personal income tax burden. Our corporate income taxes rank 18th here. This was actually a fairly good year in terms of corporate revenue. We tend to bounce around, usually in the 20s, in our relative rank on the corporate tax burden. But, of course, also notice the differences here, both nationally and in Oregon, that the corporate is a lot smaller component of the revenue system. It's a lot smaller base. In terms of sales taxes, and here I've included selective sales taxes. So this would be your excise taxes like gasoline and cigarettes. And we rank, actually, even comparing us with the other non-sales tax state, we still rank 50th in terms of sales, general and selective sales taxes. But I've got some more information to compare us with those other states, those non-sales tax states. Property taxes, of course, the big change from the 90s, from Measure 5 and then reinforced by Measure 50. Oregon went from a high property tax state, ranked 5th in 89-90, to an average property tax state. That was the fundamental change of the 1990s, and of course this made this personal income tax dependence even more significant. Now if we look at state taxes now, so I'm looking at 2002 tax year, so state taxes by source. The red bar here being the personal income tax. Oregon, for its tax revenue, all tax revenue at the state level, 71% comes from the personal income tax. And you can see if you look at the overall system as a whole, personal income and sales are pretty much the same. Actually, personal income did pull ahead of sales taxes at the national level in the 90s because income taxes grew a lot faster than sales taxes did. You can also see some of the other components, selective sales taxes. We've mentioned that's another component of the consumption base and we're below the national average in selective sales tax reliance. In fact, below the national average in everything except the other category, which does include things like severance taxes, privilege taxes, and we don't have any property tax at the state level where some states do. But of course, the key point in this is the big red bar on the personal income tax, which at 71% is the highest bar you would find among any of the states for any single category. Washington here is about 63% on sales tax. Now, if you look at us compared with the other four states who do not have a general sales tax, you can see they all have some different kind of revenue sources that they depend on. Of course, here's our income tax. Notice none of the others are as dependent on the income tax. And in fact, even Alaska doesn't have an income tax. There's no income tax and no sales taxes. But these states generally have some other category that they're dependent on that makes them distinct from the overall state and local system. For Alaska, of course, it's the other category. That's severance taxes, oil and gas severance taxes that stand out. Delaware, it's corporate franchise taxes, which they have a unique system there, and they have a lot of corporations that are incorporated there. For New Hampshire, it's a state property tax. About 26% of their state revenue comes from a statewide property tax in New Hampshire. And Montana, which has done a fair amount of tax review in the last year or so, is dependent on the personal income tax. Their personal income tax, by the way, is really more volatile than ours. They have a system where they allow full deductibility of federal taxes. Remember Measure 91. That was proposed a few years ago. They actually have a system like that. And they do have high marginal income tax rates. So they have a relatively volatile income tax system, but they have this much higher dependence on selective sales taxes or excise taxes. And they also have a fairly high dependence on property taxes at the state level. Now, just to summarize the characteristics of our revenue system, we clearly have a low tax burden. In fact, if you look at just the state tax burden only for 2002, we rank 46th in the state-only tax burden as a percentage of income. You can see that we still have higher than average spending levels, at least through the 99-2000 census year, because of this heavy reliance on these non-tax revenue sources. And that much of that occurred in the 1990s, a shift toward those sources. If you look at the distribution of our tax burden, that reflects the fact that we do have income tax dependence and no sales tax. It's roughly a proportional system, whereas most state and local systems are regressive, because the sales tax tends to be a regressive tax and must be offset by other taxes in the system. The high personal income tax burden, of course, second highest in the country, lowest consumption tax and burden in the country. And again, the big change of the 90s, moving to an average property tax burden and away from being a high property tax state. Now, in terms of the experience we've had with the Measure 5 system, Chair mentioned that you know we've are in a position now where we can review the post-Measure 5 system for the first time in terms of the complete cycle. And this has been an unusual cycle in a number of ways, but you can see the strength here in the 90s, the very rapid growth, personal income, general fund and lottery grew 129% during this period from 89-91 to 99-01. So very rapid growth here. Of course, a lot of these dollars were used to backfill for the local school property taxes, but the rapid growth in income taxes allowed the state to do that. Now you can see the drop-off here over the last, and in fact, this 0103 number here is artificially inflated by the $450 million appropriation credit bonds that were issued. That ended up being counted as general fund revenue. So this number would be lower, and then we'd have a little bit higher growth projected in 0305. But as it stands now, this growth projected is only about 4%. So, and that would put us significantly below the 99-01 level. So you're coming forward 4 years with fewer dollars in nominal terms. if you think back on 99-01 and kind of how the budget process was working through that period, how the forecast process was, you think, well, we would tend to go toward the long-term trend, and that would be a good sense of where we'll be in terms of state finances 4 years from now. Well, if you take this number and let it grow 6% annually here, which was our assumption as to long-term growth of the income tax, you can see where we would be. So this difference here is almost $3 billion between where we're projected now and where we would be just taking that 6% trend. So of course you can ask the question, what's normal, this period in here or this period in here? And that becomes a key issue as you look ahead for budgeting decisions. The decline in taxes has been very dramatic, and you can see that Oregon taxes have fallen considerably more than the overall state taxes have between 2000 and 2002. Now these numbers, our numbers are reduced by a personal income tax kicker that was sent out in 2002. That was about $253 million. But you also, in this number, the 1752 per capita number here, you also had a kicker of $167 million. So there is a kicker in this base as well. The only thing that's not in that base is a pension refund. That influenced these numbers a little bit, but you had a bigger pension refund here. Still, most of this was due to the drop in the income tax, and income tax receipts. So this is a 16.7% drop on a per capita basis, all taxes, at the state level. Really, the drop that occurred at the national level during this period is pretty much unprecedented in the World War II period, where you see an actual drop in nominal dollars of about 4% over a two-year period. Now, we're often asked about how the different revenue sources have performed over the course of the business cycle, and what I've done, the Rockefeller Institute in New York, Center for the Study of the States, keeps a quarterly tab on all states' personal income tax revenue and sales tax revenue, and then what they call general tax revenue. And you can see, look at the performance of the personal income tax in the 90s leading all the way up to, and here's the last little blip up, was in the second quarter of 01, which was, of course, when the forecast was done for the 103 biennium. But notice growth in here consistently 10% plus for the personal income tax in the late 90s on into 2000. The sales tax, on the other hand, grew in the neighborhood of 5 to 6% pretty consistently. It's dropped off near zero here and dropped negative in one quarter, but generally has been around zero. It's the personal income tax has dropped much more dramatically, and that drop is indicative of the instability of the personal income tax. So, by the way, one of the other things that I did put in your packet, as you recall, a couple of months ago, the chair referred to Governing Magazine and the review of the tax system, so I went ahead and recopied some of those state profiles, and that emphasizes Oregon's reliance on the income tax and the instability that's created in the system. You can see also I just got the first quarter of the calendar year data. I just got it last week, and you can see that personal income tax is still trending down, actually 3% decline on a year-over-year basis. The personal income tax now on a national level has been below the prior year quarter seven quarters in a row, consistent with the biennium. We've also had seven forecasts in a row that have gone down. We're also asked a lot about the Washington system, and the Washington system has exhibited a drop-off in revenue in this recession, as nearly all state systems have. But you can also, again, see the difference between the income tax volatility and the consumption tax. You don't get the growth in the 90s. You don't see it here. 95, 97 is the most classic example where you see little growth here from the sales tax in Washington, much stronger growth here in the income tax, over 20%. and then you see the income tax dropping off, and Oregon's dropping about 10% from the prior biennium. I did adjust for the appropriation credit bonds in this calculation, so we're down about 10%. Washington's down about 0.5% from the prior biennium.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Paul, before you move away from that slide, Washington also has a business and occupation tax.
Yes,
where would that graph fit in on this?
Senator Hannon, the business and occupation tax is part of that red bar.
That red bar.
It's included in there. On an annual basis, Washington generates a little over $5 billion with a sales tax, a little over $2 billion on the B&O tax. So that's on an annual basis. So you add the two of those together, you get about $15 billion of biennium.
Okay. Thank you.
So in terms of the overview of the system and kind of what we've learned over the last couple of years, or really over the last 10 years, raises some issues in terms of how to evaluate tax reform proposals. And these are the key issues that I've listed, and these are the things that to go through in terms of a checklist as to look at alternative proposals. I think probably the most important issue for people is adequacy. It's also one of the most difficult to define. There is no ideal level of government, but revenue systems are designed to provide funding for public services. I mean, that's their primary function. So if you determine the size of government that's optimal or desirable, then it becomes a question of finding the least costly way to raise that revenue. So the adequacy issue drives everything in terms of revenue policy. Now, then you ask the question about, okay, we've got to raise a certain amount of revenue. How do we do it? Well, probably the most important concern that individuals have, if you were to ask them, the public has, is fairness or equity. And that, of course, is a lot easier to say than do. We can look at the distribution of the tax burden, and any proposals that you look at, we will look at it on a distributional basis. We can also look at things and discuss things in terms of benefits received. And many taxes probably should be viewed in that way, particularly business taxes. If you're talking about fairness, you can look in terms of fairness relative to the public benefits received. The next issue is on economic growth. And again, we can look at this through OTIM and its impact. We think of Oregon as an open economy where labor and capital can flow in and out of our borders. So that means that the tax system, revenue system, can be an important factor because it influences the rate of return on capital and the rate of return from labor, too. Of course, interaction with the federal system is another major factor, the deductibility or non-deductibility, how our tax system connects with the federal one in terms of the income tax. And then finally, administration and compliance. We do have, in terms of your hearings for the remainder of this week, on Wednesday, Director Harchenko will be in, along with Bruce Johnson from the Utah State Tax Commission, to talk about some of the issues around the streamlined sales tax, how that implications are for Oregon, and that becomes an important issue in terms of administration and compliance. So I will wrap things up here by just kind of putting this tax reform approach box for your consideration. And this is really what I've asked Bruce Weber and Tony Ruffalo tomorrow to kind of walk through some of these approaches and what they may see as advantages and disadvantages. But just to summarize them briefly for you, the first issue, the first approach, if your objective is to try to achieve a more stable revenue system, to try to lower marginal income tax rates in terms of long-term economic growth, one approach would be to broaden the income tax base. Or you could move in the extreme, move all the way to adjusted gross income base and start from there, essentially eliminate all credits and deductions and subtractions and start over again. That would be one major tax reform approach. In doing so, you know, you'd have to go through that tax expenditure report and eliminate a whole series of those tax expenditures and try to reduce marginal income tax rates and increase the overall tax threshold on when you begin paying income taxes. The second approach is to move incrementally to the consumption base, which would mean we're the lowest, have the least reliance on the consumption base, to make incremental steps in that direction. I would argue we've done that kind of an indirect way without really doing it as an overall strategy, but lottery expansion, increased use of charges have been two strong characteristics of the 90s. That does move you kind of indirectly to the consumption base. The other option is to go toward excise taxes. You've talked about beer and wine taxes, but there's a whole series of things, specific kinds of things that could be taxed that would represent a marginal step or an incremental step consumption base. The other approach, another approach would be to go broadly to the consumption base. And you have three major options that are available: the retail sales tax that has been proposed a number of times in Oregon, value-added tax that's been discussed, and we have a bill now in the Senate Revenue Committee that would propose going in that direction, and a gross receipts tax. Any of those would reflect a major step toward the consumption base. And finally, the fourth option would be to shift back toward the property base, back toward reverse some of the shift we've seen over the last decade and 13 years or so now. Finally, the issue of why tax reform is so hard and why it's one that has not been successful in the past, I think there's a couple of points to keep in mind. One is that, you know, if you look at the adequacy issue, really you're raising taxes to provide services, and taxes are a cost to the system. I think that's very hard for the public, because it's very easy to say, well, this tax has these negative effects. But in economic terms, that's true. Taxes are a cost. They discourage whatever you tax. And again, they have to be the result of some economic activity. So you're discouraging some type of economic activity. A second point I think that you'll hear over and over again in terms of the revenue system is, gee, you can't change the tax system because these decisions have been based on that old system. And, of course, that creates powerful forces for inertia, because no matter how bad the system is, it's always the argument that, gee, we've made decisions based on that system. And now when you change that system, some of those decisions no longer pencil out. And that's a major obstacle for any tax reform proposal, no matter how justified it can be on other grounds. Whatever new system you have creates uncertainty. I mean, that's kind of a corollary to this, but it's going to create uncertainty, and uncertainty in the revenue system usually, again, generates a lot of opposition. And finally, one that I don't need to talk to you about is the public is suspicious of government in general and see discussion of taxes as somehow leading to some negative consequences for them individually. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll see if there are any questions, and then turn it over to Governor Attia.
Thank you very much, Paul. Are there questions from committee members or comments, reflections on any of the information we've seen so far? I want to thank you for putting up that last point on your last bullet.
Mr. Chairman.
We should have had somebody review this before. Representative Williams.
Paul, on the slide just before the last one, that was the tax reform approaches, I just wanted to be clear. That's the one that tomorrow we're going to, you and Dr. Ruffalo and I forget who the third.
Bruce Weimer.
We're going to go over those in some detail tomorrow. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. We will walk through these and get into a discussion, interaction with you on what the pros and cons are of each of those approaches. They all have cons and they all have pros relative to the current system. I'm assuming here that the overall goal is to reduce instability in the system and to diversify the revenue system, except for that first point, which is really to make the income tax perform more efficiently and more in a more stable way would be the first approach, with the broadening the income tax base. So But the goal is to achieve greater stability and do it in a way that, would end up encouraging long-term economic growth.
Representative Funk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to make sure I understand. On slide 3, we're listing Oregon's rank in the various forms of taxes. Under corporate tax, Oregon's ranked 18th. That's 18th highest, is that correct, in the nation?
Yes, these are all ranked in terms of, so one would be highest. So we're ranked second highest in the personal income tax, 18th in the corporate. That, you know, having done these charts at least for a decade, that's high for us on corporate. That bounces around because of the, you know, whether it was a good year or not. We've typically been in the 20s, anywhere from 22 to 26 or 7. So that is a relatively high number. Keep in mind the year there, 99-2000, and the fact that last fiscal year, 102, corporate income tax revenue dropped 47%. So it's kind of hard to say where we are right now. We know it dropped nationally, but I doubt seriously it dropped that much. So I suspect that ranking, we're probably lower now.
Thank you. Just one comment, if I may. The reason I brought that up is because I hear quite often that Oregon is low on corporate taxes, but this points out that actually we're well above the median on corporate taxes.
Well, I think over time, if our ranking has been pretty close to average.
Any other comments or questions for Paul on this information? It's not particularly new to us, but I think it's good for as a starting point to lay this out for not only our refresher, but also those who are watching this to understand where we're coming from on this. So thank you very much, Paul, if you want to come on up and join us here at the desk. Next, I want to welcome former Governor Vic Tia, a veteran of the tax reform wars from days gone by, but also still in the fray, and happy to have him. And Tony Van Vliet. Tony, I see you in the back. If you want to come on forward, too. We've invited Governor Tia and former Representative Van Vliet to address us today on some of their personal reflections and experiences on the history of tax reform efforts. I guess understanding that if you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it. So maybe we can learn from some of their experiences as we look forward today.
Just as long as we don't have to hear from Central Oregon, Mr. Chair.
I think we will hear from Central Oregon next week.
Next week?
Yes.
Thanks for the warning.
We'll let you know ahead of time. Governor Tia, do you want to go first? Welcome to you. Glad to see you back with us this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committees. As I sat and listened to Paul, I thought to myself, this is a recording. I was, as the chairman, Rev Shirley knows, chairman of an advisory committee to the Legislative Task Force on Revenue Options, School Funding, and Accountability. We had 5 meetings ending in December 10th of last year. There were 13 remarkable and very brilliant citizens, and we were assisted by 2 Senate and 2 House ex officio members. I'm telling you all this, 2 things. You don't have to tell me, but I wonder how many of you have read that report. But second, one of our very bright members said as we were concluding that she regretted we did not come up with something new. And I told her flat out, there is nothing new. In 20 legislative years, I was a member of a tax committee. Unusual to be on a committee for that period of time. And as 8 years as governor, we wrestled with taxation. I've heard everyone's tax plan, including my own, and heard from the others who always stood by and only criticized and never offered solutions. And so here we are on June 30th of this year, 2003, and once more we are desperately at it again. I think back to, and this will sound like a long time to you, but to me too. In 1959, when I started in the Oregon legislature, the prior session had hired a Dr. Sly, an expert in taxation. And he made a presentation to the joint session of the Oregon legislature about what we ought to do. And he said, when the state of Oregon reaches a budget of $300 million, we need a new tax system. Well, we've gone well beyond $300 million. And we haven't had a new tax system. A train wreck occurred, ballot measure 5. It created a dramatic and historical shift in the relationship between state and local government. And incidentally, this is interesting, I think back because it used to be in the statutes, it's changed, but it in the statute, we got our income tax in 1929, and it was labeled there in the statute of the Property Tax Relief Act of 1929. As ballot 5 was on the ballot, and I listened to many people, and I kept saying that this is a dangerous piece of legislation, and it wasn't a matter of not wanting property tax, but that was not the one we should have had. And I said to my friends and anyone else who would listen, if you want to know what the impact of ballot 5 on education will be, look today, this is when ballot 5 was on the ballot, look today at California after Proposition 13. And it was clear to me, and prior to that time, whenever we heard about education and equality and something new and innovative, and California would always come up. And after Proposition 13, you never heard about education in California again. And you know the problem we're having with education because of ballot 5. And I'm trying to dramatize what a train wreck ballot 5 was. And I've said repeatedly, it was a terrible mistake by the citizens of the state of Oregon to have passed it. After that, we had so many missed opportunities from the executive branch of government as well as the legislative leaders to warn Oregonians. And in happier economic times, the budget was continually overloaded. I'm not picking on it particularly, but you know what the amount of, and a classic in that regard, was the Oregon Health Plan. Huge. A huge addition, besides the shift of dollars from the state, from the local government to the state. And our economy soured. Many of those who paid for all the expensive wishes of others lost their jobs and their income and could no longer put money in the collection tray. I think we need to make that connection. We can't print money. The only way we get money in the state of Oregon is by Oregonians working and paying taxes. There is no other way to do that. So that's how we got here. What do we do? I happen to believe that if you're going to comment and criticize, you need to come up with an answer. So here's mine. Do with it what you want. Usually when you go 1, 2, 3, 4, and you'd say not in any particular order, but this is in a particular order. First, do everything that you can to stimulate our economy. Get our taxpaying donors to all those programs that everyone seems to want, get them back to work. And I want to remind you how strongly I feel about that. I called three special sessions in 1982 to rebalance our budget. As I was cutting budgets, I added money to the Department of Economic Development. Second, let's not have any more studies, interim committees, or tax forces. It's been studied to death. The least that you and other members of the legislature can do is to go back and read the reports of even just recent years. There's some good ones. Take a recess and have the membership give it to them and tell them to read it. Third, put common sense into spending. Decide on the essential things, essential, and the desirable. Someone asked me after my first session, are you a lawyer? And I said, no, I'm not a lawyer. He said, don't you have to be a lawyer? I said, no, you don't have to be a lawyer. All you need are principles and common sense. That's all you need. And then you let Oregonians know what you're doing, that you are indeed on their side. Fourth, speak out and let Oregonians know we really do have a problem. And I can prove to you how Oregonians react. You've seen it. This last election, Oregonians, certainly in the metropolitan area, did decide that there was a problem, and they did pass a tax. Fifth, I hope you notice it is fifth, we deal with what you're working on, straighten out the tax mess. I'm going to prove my case. In 2002, and now I presume, you're dealing with 8% unemployment. And I'm reading the newspaper, talking to some of my friends, but I'm reading what's going on, and I get the sense of a great hysteria. People are riding off in all directions at once. What a terrible thing. The sky's falling. And it is bad. 8% is a horrendous figure. Do you know what I was dealing with in 1982? 12.6% unemployment. Do you remember anything about the sky falling or anything like that? No. We squarely faced the issue. Me and the legislature. We fairly and equally dealt with our budget. We placed a temporary surtax. And we went on through life. We got through this whole thing, and all the while, as I was telling you, diversifying the economy. I've heard the cry of, and reading in the paper, what we need is a dependable source of income for schools. We had it. It was called a property tax. Whether you like it or not, it was a dependable source of income. Whether you made money or not, it didn't make any difference. You had a house that was worth $100,000, you'd pay taxes on that. That was a dependable source of income. Now, I know of no other dependable source like that. You might come close to it. I heard Paul as he was telling you about the things you could do. And then we come to number six. And I ask you to dust off the tax measure that Paul mentioned to you. I'm serious about that. To give you only the rough of it, it reduced income tax. It controlled the growth of property taxes. And heaven forbid, it included a sales tax. So I'll show you a little sense of a little history. We had our campaign. Incidentally, I think it was 1985, Paul, and when the legislature was in session, we did that. But one of our campaigns was a comic book. We got ridiculed to death about this. But here's the comic book. But someone shared with me there was someone that before us had a comic book, and it was Wayne Morris. There are ways, if you feel about it, you know, try to do something different. But I do urge you to go back and take a look at that tax measure. It doesn't have to be just that, and it certainly needs some updating and some fixing. But it's sure going to jump off. It's a good one to jump off. It's, what it is a balanced plan. It isn't just a sales tax or a property tax or an income tax. It was a balance between them. I hate that description, three-legged stool. But anyway, it was a balanced plan. And then I suggest you refer it to the vote of the people. And I do that for two reasons. First is a matter of timing. If you refer it, you can say when the election date is. The second is that it's going to be referred anyway. In that event, it's put off until the next statewide election. And at least, if you decide to pass it, you ought to put in that measure when it would go to election if the people referred it. And all the while, you tell the people, the naysayers, and they're gearing up, and they've been geared up for a long time. You cannot have a change and retain the status quo. It's impossible. And was my plan a perfect plan? No. But there never was and never will be a perfect plan. Not mine, not yours, not anyone. And I want you to cast aside the concept of political pressure. Because there's only one person that can put political pressure on you, and that's you. Nobody else can put political pressure on you. You just put it on yourself. And please remember two things. We were not elected to make only the easy decisions. We were elected to make tough ones too. And we were not elected to run for re-election. And if you're waiting to please everyone, of course, eternity is not long enough. My favorite story about not being able to please everyone, and some of you have heard it, but it would bear repeating, about the grandmother walking with her son, or grandson, excuse me, out on the beach, and a sudden wave came and swept her grandson out into the ocean. She dropped to her knees and prayed to the Lord, please return my grandson. The young man, a full life ahead of him. I've been faithful to the church. I've attended. I've given money. Please, Lord, return my grandson. And the next wave deposited her grandson safely at her knees. And she looked up and said, he had a hat. I told my staff as we began my process as a governor, and we had staff meetings, and say, Governor, we have this problem. I'd say, well, we don't have any problems in Oregon. They're all opportunities. And this is an opportunity. You are at a critical juncture of our history. I'm telling you that not in that cliche form. Indeed, you are. If you fail to act, we will continue to drag our state of Oregon through the mud. And no one will remember this year, and no one will remember you. If, on the other hand, you succeed, you will be forever remembered. And I want to say beyond this wall, beyond this building, to anyone that's listening, I really quite put out when I keep hearing the legislature has never done anything. The legislature did this, the legislature did that. The legislature has done an awful lot. Over the years, and Paul can tell you how many times measures have been sent to the people of the state of Oregon. It's the people that turned it down. They say, well, I would like to have a change, but not this one. That's the old cliche. I'm not this one. I must tell you that as a member of the legislature in the past, I really am kind of offended when that is a repeated time and time again. Sure, you've made mistakes. You're human beings. But you've tried. Now I want to end with one of my favorite quotes. And I would tell you that you can use it any time you want. On some positions, cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? There comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe nor politic nor popular. But they must take it because conscience says it is right. It's not mine. That's Dr. Martin Luther King. I believe that. You've got a tough job. I've read this Oregonian article, A Case Against Oregon Sales Tax. You know, it could be. This is a recording. It's the same stuff over and over again. I'm not suggesting that you jump on my plan, but I think it'd be a good place to start. Anyway, from my perspective of all those years, and, you know, I've been out of office. I've never left my interest wane at all about my state. You won't because you ran for office and you're working here. God, I can remember the first time we went into July. I was kind of put out about that. Anyway, thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you, Governor. If I can, let's... If I can ask you to stay where you are, let's hear from Representative Van Vliet, and then we'll have a chance for maybe a full-range conversation with both of you and the committee, if that's all right with everybody. All right. Tony Van Vliet, welcome to you, sir.
Thank you very much for inviting me here today and participating in the process, and I'm especially happy to be sitting on the right of Governor Attia, who I have great admiration and served with and think he was one of the best governors we ever had. I'm not going to speak today as a person who has walked 10 miles in the snow. I want to read off of this, though, in very concise statements, because I think the written word is sometimes more precise than just off the top of my head. The key question, I think, that remains today is, what is the function of government in a civilized society? Government provides services to its citizens as a product. It pays dividends by doing what is effective and in a courteous way. And if it does that in a caring way, the public will purchase stock in the form of revenue. As legislators, we make sure this is carried out in a caring way by evaluating the management of our agencies and making sure they have the proper resources to do their jobs. This is not an easy task, nor is it a place that legislators empowered with that trust can use that position to starve out those they personally dislike. So now we have arrived at a moment that the famous Sly Report wrote in 1958, and I was very glad that Governor Attia brought that up, because it is really a very fine study. Anybody who studies taxation ought to read the Sly Report. And I'll give a little different quote, but it is off the same page, really. It says, equity cannot be achieved by any single tax base and still raise the money required by the public services of today. At least no fully self-governing area has found it possible. Now, during my 4 years in revenue and 16 years on ways and means, I became more convinced than ever that Oregon could not continue to meet the needs of its citizens. We had added more than 1 million people to the state in less than 25 years. That fact is often forgotten by naysayers who think that we can still provide services at a much lower rate. And we've had some of the worst anti-government and anti-education initiatives passed, and we're being influenced now by the erratic flow of revenues, of which ordinarily we're not responsible. Most of it is we're catching a cold from whatever that happens on the national economy. During those years in the legislature, we did provide creative solutions, and I was very glad to hear Governor Attia say that, because I feel sincerely about that we offered several. But we talked about taxation rather than services, and I think this may have been our fatal flaw over those years in which we tried a sales tax measure in 83, in 85, and in 91. We always talked about taxation and the need for taxation, but never about the need for services. In the recession of 80-86, which we shared together, we were reducing a $2.8 billion general fund by $600 million. We found $300 and we had to raise $300, and we went out and did it. I think your problem today is you need not only a short-term solution, but you also need to work on a long-term one. And the long-term one we're talking about here, but the short-term one is still facing you. In 1991, the first year of Measure 5, in which I was co-chairman of Ways and Means, we cut $97 million in human resources, and we left over $100 million of building maintenance of state facilities, universities, and campuses and other state facilities. Those were untouched. And we also, at the same time, we promised richer school districts that it was not our intent to lower them, but to bring others up to a level as we move to a federally mandated equalization plan over the years. That went off the radar screen in the subsequent years. So here we are today, humbled by cartoons and a national press, not only for our schools, but for our human resources, seeking to stabilize our revenues and bring them back. And this legislature can do it. You need that third leg that gives you some fighting chance to meet economic doldrums. Now I'll get a little personal. I'm a grandfather with 5 children in elementary and middle schools in Portland and Tualatin. And I'm frankly tired of seeing what's happening to Oregon. I'm tired of losing good school teachers who have classes of 40 kids and have to buy their own materials. I'm tired of parents having to go out and run cookie sales in order to provide textbooks. I'm tired of losing people off the Oregon Health Plan, which ultimately will cost you more money in the long run. I'm tired of having raised user fees beyond what is fair and reasonable. No one should be deprived of visiting our parks. And I'm tired of excessive money being put into politics that allows you to be threatened by people to sign pledges or face their wrath. I believe the people of the state of Oregon, once they know these desired services can be shared all the way down from county and city levels, will support whatever you come up with if it is presented in the correct way. I believe they will listen. Oregonians are good listeners. We should be able to show people that if they put a dollar here, they can save $20 over here. That's a job of Ways and Means. Having co-authored and been involved in 3 tax measures, we have never been able to explain these plans were revenue neutral and met the requirements of fairness and stability before its detractors came up out of the manhole covers. It is a challenge that remains that whatever path you choose, you are going to have to do something this legislative session. But I do believe, and this is where I may disagree with the governor, that whatever kind of third leg you attach to that stool, whichever tax plan, you must pass it with a great abundance of members of this legislature and have all your leadership and most of your assembly ready to do hand-to-hand combat in explaining services lost or needed. It is not a moment for political advantage. Tax and spend is no longer a usable cliché, but neither is long-range harm to our children and citizens of cut and borrow, which is ethically far worse in the long term. So as a good friend of mine says as he finishes up his talks, thanks for listening and the use of the hall.
All right. Thank you very much. I want to open up for comments, questions from committee members to this excellent testimony from Governor Attia and from Representative Van Fleet. Ready? Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, the other day I was rummaging around in my basement and I opened a small old yellowing photo album. And in that photo album, it was 1981, and it was a picture of me presenting an award to Governor Attia at a Boy Scout Day at the Capitol in 1981. And I couldn't have been prouder on that day, Governor, and I couldn't be prouder to have you here sharing your thoughts and testimony with us this morning. You know, obviously we're starting with the big picture here over the next 2 weeks and moving towards tax reform. I think it would be interesting from both you and Representative Van Vliet's experience if maybe you could share with us some of the particular sticking points that you bumped into along the way as you were trying to develop a tax reform package, both within the building and outside the building, and any suggestions you'd have for us about how to address those issues. Both of you, I think, commented on our need to sort of sell this to the public and some of the challenges that you had. As we try to move the discussion and help people identify that there is a structural problem, we can talk about if it's enough money, if it's not enough money, if it's revenue neutral, not revenue neutral, but from the structural standpoint, what would you recommend we do to try to convince the voters in Oregon that there is a structural problem in the system?
That's very hard to explain. If you look at, probably a good exercise, if you look at Multnomah County, in which there was a good campaign and described to people the problems they were having there, had a good campaign put together and passed a tax. I happen to think that's a mistake, because that's a mistake in terms of people coming into Multnomah County. You know, they Washington County or Clackamas County, but that anyway, the people did it. And what I was trying to portray when I was talking in my testimony that proves that if you can convince Oregonians there's a problem, Oregonians will respond. I believe that. That's why I say there was lost opportunities way back to begin to explain them. Then, now we get into a sensitive area, but the whole squabbling between who's Republican and who's a Democrat and who's the majority and who isn't a majority, you're not here for any other reason than to help the people of the state of Oregon, not your party, not my party or your party, anybody's party. We're not here for that reason. Well, I'm a partisan. I'm a Republican. I'm going to work for Republican candidates, but not what I'm here. I'm here for the people's business. Now, there has been a minimum without our law, just reading the paper, that somehow or other the varnish is wearing thin. But stay with it. I think it means that we all are working together, Republicans and Democrats. There's going to be a lot of people say, what a terrible thing you're doing, whatever it is you're doing. Whatever you come up with, it's going to be terrible. So get ready for that one. But I think if you can tell people in Oregon that we do have a problem, and this is the way we're going to solve it, I do think they'll respond. I believe that. They believed it when we put a surtax on. They believed us when we said it's only going to be for a period of time. You know, usually you say, yeah, I know, they're going to run it. We ran it just for a period of time, and it was over. They believed us. Well, that's one answer.
Well, I can only share my experience of in the coming before this committee in 1982 in an interim period with my three-legged stool, which I think I'm going to give to the Oregon Historical Society one of these days, and meeting a young representative outside in the hall who wanted to join forces in Representative Courtney, and we decided that it was time to do something, and the sales tax, of course, came up, and we decided that that was the route to go. We locked ourselves in a room for several months with Rich Munn and Barbara Seymour, legislative counsel. We have to give much of the credit for what was in that particular sales tax to her superb research work that she had did on all 50 states on what was in there as sales taxes and those that existed at that time. And that tax lowered property taxes, and it also lowered income taxes. It had the Vermont plan in there, which was to help out low-income people. And it was a 4% sales tax, which you would have, if it had been in place today, you'd probably be in a little bit better shape. We did not allow any lobby in with us during that entire time until we made our presentation in 1983. And, of course, snapping turtles came up on the beach immediately, which you would expect to happen. But it was surprisingly, it didn't get touched very much. It was written well enough. That bill, I think, is pretty much what was built on in 1983. 1981, when we were looking at the repercussions of ballot measure 5, it was reintroduced at that time as an Ed-Med bill with 4 cent sales tax and 1 cent going to Oregon Health Plan. It was very much supported by the governor of the state, but it never got out of committee. And I think the biggest difficulty you have with a sales tax is you're dealing with probably 50 years of a very loyal group of anti-sales tax people who are willing to go out there and work their hands and hearts to defeat any kind of a sales tax. So that's the effort when I say that the leadership and the majority of the legislature, you cannot have people in the legislative process who simply pass the measure and then go out and start to work against it. It doesn't work. You need to have everybody putting their shoulder to the wheels and make it totally nonpartisan. It's the only way you'll get any taxation passed. I think that worked on the surtax when we needed it, yeah. And it will only way it'll work in probably getting any kind of a stable tax situation in the state of Oregon. Now, whether you pick a sales tax or a gross receipts tax or whatever you do, it's going to have that kind of support. And that is, you have to go out and talk about services, and you have to go out and have everybody behind the wheel.
That may be just a perspective from what I was talking about in 22. All my years as a governor, the Democrats controlled the legislature, including 1982 when we had the surtax and cut budgets and all the rest of that. I just want to give you the perspective of that.
Other comments? Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Welcome, Governor Attia. You know my district pretty well. I'm from the South Coast, and through your good friend, Jim Benningfield, you've visited there many times. One of the things that the people tell me there is they don't care what you call it. They only want to give you a certain percentage of their income. I mean, you can call it sales tax, income tax, property tax, but they feel that there's a line there that they don't want to go beyond that, and they don't want government to go beyond that. Would you respond to that?
Sure. As a matter of fact, I just do not pay any tax at all. But we understand there's one other thing that needs to be said. I said, as a governor, I don't believe there shouldn't be no government. There has to be some government. And so when you ask a question like you say, people say that there's a certain limit. I suppose that limit depends on who you are. But they do understand that if we want to give services to the people of the state of Oregon, it's going to cost money, and the only place we get it is from them. Now, when we talk about the plan I'm talking about, which was a three-way, it cut income taxes and it controlled the growth of property taxes, and the whole thing is revenue neutral. It doesn't. All that means is somebody else is going to pay it that wasn't paying it before.
Right.
But there's no more money that was being taken in. All I can do is just say, folks, you know, if you want it, we have to do it. Now, nobody's going to be very excited about it. I don't know if anybody's going to say, hooray, we raised taxes. Just, that's not part of the deal. Incidentally, I do want to say one thing about Oregon. There's a gene that's, when you're born in Oregon, you get a gene inserted there about sales tax. You can't have something to do with it. And then we have people from other states that have sales tax and come here and find out we don't have one and they like it. So those are the speed bumps we're dealing with when you start talking about just a sales tax. But I think if you start talking in terms of a balanced plan, it makes more sense. But I can't argue. Sure, I don't want to pay any taxes any more than anybody else wants to pay taxes. All I can say is I agree with you, but that's the way it is.
Other comments, questions? Senator Hannan.
Yes, Governor and Representative. Since I served with both of you, and I think that you exemplified today what this process is all about, is that when you're in this building, you join hands as Oregonians, not Democrats or Republicans, but as Oregonians. And I think somehow we've lost that sight and lost that vision. I guess what I would like to say is, in your communication here to us today, I hope that some of our colleagues accept this as what we need to do. There's two things we need to achieve. A short-term solution to develop the budget and balance it on this biennium, and then come up with the reform that we're discussing and present that for consideration. But it's going to require some people to walk the plank and make some difficult votes. We did that back in the 80s when you were governor and you were representative. And I don't recall anyone losing their seat from election because they stood up and made a difficult choice. As a matter of fact, you were right in the middle of your reelection as governor when we passed the surcharge. And I don't recall you being defeated.
Nor does the current governor.
I think what we need to do is realize that we can worry about elections, but it's the wrong thing to be worrying about. Yeah. We should be worrying about, is the schools going to be open for 180 days or 120 days? Are we going to hire teachers this fall, or are we going to lay off teachers this fall? Are we going to have law enforcement on our streets and our highways, or are we going to have additional chaos and wrecks and carnage on our highways and streets? Now, these are the things, and you've communicated here very well and articulated this morning what we need to do. I would only ask you, Governor and Representative, to continue to work with us, to continue to show us that we need to create that backbone to do what's right, not what is politically expedient. So thank you both for being here, and I really compliment both of you.
Senator Corcoran?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome to you both. It struck me, Tony, that must have been a horrible experience being locked in a room with Peter Courtney for months.
It was an experience.
That probably started pharmaceutical inflation. The point I wanted to make is that you talked about the mistake being talking about taxation instead of services, and that's actually at the base of the dispute this time in the building even. The one thing that's really different from the times you guys were here, I think, is that I guess they did a skit over at the Dorchester, and it was pointed out that at the time there were three Republicans elected statewide and a governor, and that a lot of those folks would have had a hard time making it out of primary these days, and there is a lot of threat on positions if people support taxes. And I wondered if you could give us some indication as moderate Republicans how we can overcome this debate about either, you know, you give us, you know, we're being told as Democrats, you give us a number and we'll fill the services into that number. And the Democrats are saying, we'll tell you what the services that need to be filled are, and then you bring the budget up to that. Can you give us any hints on how to talk to the more conservative Republicans about how to negotiate that deal? I mean, we're either going to have tax reform or we're not. I really want to thank all the Republicans over in the House for provoking at least this discussion, and especially Representative Westland's interest in this. I'm very encouraged by that. But how do we talk to the folks who have had to sign the No New Tax Pledge? How do we get them to join hands, like Lenny says?
Well, the first step is willing to sit down and start talking about compromises that need to be made. If you can't take that first step, you're not going to get anywhere. Each position is going to get hardened. The Republican caucus, as I remember it, as when I was in it, was basically a discussion group, not a vote-getting group. It was to basically talk about the merits of particular budgets. Now, Ways and Means chairs have one hell of a time in a caucus. There's just no question about trying to explain what budgets are about, because most people don't have the advantage of sitting 4 to 6 hours a day on budgets and visiting facilities and seeing what's out there. And when they come to talk to caucuses, you're dealing with people who have already got very hard and fastened positions. So you've got to basically really make that first step of willingness to listen and compromise on the subject. Otherwise, you will not get there. And I think that is the secret of why the caucuses have to work extra hard to do that today, which may be a little bit different than what we were facing back in our time.
One other thing I think is important as you deal with human beings is, I've tried to compromise. I was a member of the minority my entire 28 years in public office. Entire 28 years. But we talked, we respected one another. We, you know, somebody has a different opinion than mine, they just have a different opinion than mine. They're not the enemy. And you have to treat them as people that have those opinions. But I think you need to say, I've got an opinion too. And I'd appreciate if you'd listen to what I'd say. Tony said the word, if you can talk together, you're going to arrive at it, but it's a give and take thing. The strong conservatives, I'm trying to pick the right word here, the strong conservatives in my party, they're well-intentioned people. They're honest and hardworking, and they believe what they believe in. But they should learn to respect you and your opinion. And I think if we get to the point of mutual trust, it'll all work out. Treat them as human beings, not as partisan people.
Representative Hess.
Thank you, and to add my welcome to both of you, Governor and Representative, Governor and constituent of mine. Hmm. Want it, later on, I'll give you a tour of the Capitol.
Maybe take up the old man.
Yeah. You have a card that says that you visited me while you were here. Thank you.
I'll follow up on this discussion because I think it really is important. A lot of what we'll do on some sort of tax reform will be mostly technical, but a larger issue here is political. And Oregon, the political atmosphere and a lot of other things has changed since the 80s, and it is maybe not as kind and gentle as it used to be. And I'm sure you could say you've had some scars from some past campaigns, but we have an era now that we have talk radio. We have million-dollar legislative campaigns. And I was just wondering what your take was on why that is so and why this climate is a little more difficult than it used to be and what suggestions you might have to try to get back to where we were.
You first. Well, we are getting far afield, but Mark, I have to agree with you. That's I've noticed, as a matter of fact, through my career, I've said many times when I started off way back when I told you when I started, and people would write to me and say, Representative Attia or then Senator Attia, you voted the other way, and I'd be appreciated to know why. They must have a reason, so you'd respond to them. As time moves along, it became more strident, and pretty soon it got to the point you'd become nut. I'm not ever going to vote for you. I don't see it. All my friends are going to defeat you. You get real angry. Why? Well, people don't like to necessarily hear this, but I'll tell you what I think why. I was in the bus depot waiting for my granddaughter, who's coming up on the bus, and waiting, and I was walking around there, and then there was a video game. And here was this young man playing the video game. And what was the video game? Well, it was a machine gun. And the thing was, he was shooting and killing people in a video game. Where I'm coming from, it's not guns or machine guns or anything. I'm talking about things in music, things and television, things and video games. And that excites people. Their adrenaline's running. They think that's the way to go. And so they were raising a group of people in society that think violence is okay. Now, violence, obviously, nobody's going to, very few people go out and shoot people, but they get angry. And so we're going to intimidate you. We're going to frighten you. This, incidentally, is not any part of your responsibility. But you ask me, and I'm telling you. And I think that there's more tendency toward blackness and moral standards and violence than there was when I started in 19... Well, there's no question about 1959. We barely had television in those days, so... No, we had television. But anyway, I feel I just... I don't have to go beyond that. I feel strongly about it. Maybe I didn't articulate it right, but that's the way I feel.
There's one thing I like to say about... In the height of the Enron and WorldCom situation, there was a series put on public broadcasting about people getting together and talking about what was required for ethical functioning. And it requires all five things. Not one of them can be eliminated, and if caucuses would deal with this, they could come to their compromises much faster. Honesty, fairness, respect, responsibility, compassion. It's neither situational, nor is it relative. It is ethical functioning. And if people would start to think in those terms and work together and put all of those five things to work, you will be able to solve your problems, I think, a lot faster than you're facing today.
Let me, if I can, take this back to the issue of tax reform and some aspect of that we've touched on. Reforming the revenue system. Tony, you mentioned also identifying a level of services that people wanted. But, you know, there's another aspect now that maybe I'm not sure was so much a part of the debate in the 80s or even in the early 90s, and that is the spending side. We saw in the graph the level to which spending rose during the 1990s, and so now I think you have a strong sentiment out there. We hear it, I know, and see it in our emails that you don't have a revenue problem, you have a spending problem. You've grown the size of government beyond the ability of government to sustain itself through lack of restraint and spending. And so I guess I would like to know, in either of the iterations of tax reform that you've dealt with in the 80s or 90s, or whether, I'll ask the question first, I guess, was there a spending component, that is, some limitation on spending that was incorporated in either of those tax reform proposals, either as a spending cap or a rate limitation or something like that? And what do you see the place of that in the debate currently, given where we are now? Is that a necessary element of tax reform as we look at it in 2003?
Well, you know, we were in the great euphoria in 1979 of having revenue come in, and all of a sudden the bottom dropped out, and it really dropped out. It was close to a major depression, really. We call it a recession. And I think at that time, we didn't have to worry about spending so much because we were basically fighting for life, so to speak, and trying to make ends meet. And that's where we came into what we did here. And, of course, in a sense, you're doing that. But one of the things that is not shown, if I was a person who felt that the revenues were going up in a straight line, if you look at the chart over those years of which we had the heyday, you look at that line and it goes up, and people's automatic reaction is, you've got plenty of money, don't bother us. We're in tough shape, we don't want to pay any more. But a chart that I always showed to the League of Women Voters and a lot of other groups, if you adjust that chart to inflation and population growth, you will see that that line is not very steep. In fact, you are at a budget right now that's the equivalent of back in late 90s. Right? And that is the problem you have in showing people really the fact that we're dealing with 1 million more people in the state of Oregon, a lot more kids, a lot more people with Alzheimer's, a lot more people with serious problems out there. And we're not facing up to the reality that that thing is not really that steep. It is really much flatter when you make those adjustments. And that chart is never shown by the opposition.
While I was serving as governor, there was a limitation on the growth of state government as well as the budget growth of state government, as well as the growth of state employees. If I recall correctly, and it goes back a long ways, it was percent of the growth of personal income that was the cap on what the growth of state government should be. And the percentage growth of public employees, I don't recall how we got to that formula. And where it went, I don't know. All during my 8 years, that was there. We never worried about it because we were always under it. So it wasn't a matter of big debate, but it was there. And yes, the answer is there should be controlled growth. I always believed it was wonderful to have it in the growth of personal income, because that's how the folks out there are doing. If it's going well, then you've got that percent. If it's not going well, that's, you know, it all relates to how the folks out there are doing. And that's a good formula.
Anything else, members? All right, I guess we'll wrap up then. Again, I want to thank Governor Tina, Representative Van Vliet, for joining us today. I really appreciate your time and your reflections on the history here that's very relevant to what we are doing. Tomorrow we will be hearing from three PhD economists on tax options. So come with sharp pencils and smart questions.
Green visors.
Green visors, that's right. And then Wednesday, as Paul said, we will have someone from we'll have Dr. Harchenko and Bruce Johnson of the Utah State Tax Commission to talk about the streamlined sales tax agreement and other technical issues. And then Thursday we have perspectives from business, labor, and other public policy organizations before us. So,
and then maybe Friday, Mr. Chair, we could hear from Representative Westland.
Yeah, that's right. With that committee. Oh, and also, would you make a note, we're planning on an evening meeting next Monday for public testimony. Evening meeting next Monday. And perhaps one more next week, depending on how that goes. So with that, we are adjourned.